Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hello there. This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry speaking to you from inside the white bubble in America. That's right. I've had to ask myself, in light of some disheartening statistics on separation of the races in this country, stats we're going to talk about later this hour, would I have as many non-white friends and acquaintances as I do if I wasn't a radio host who's paid to talk to lots of people all the time every day? The stats say probably not. The stats say blacks have 10 times the number of white friends on average as your typical white person's number of black friends. Great. Separation of the races. Just what we need. No guilt trips, though. Just the human dimension of some interesting numbers later this hour. But we start with an attempt to clarify U.S. foreign policy. The United States authorizes surveillance flights to gather intelligence about ISIS over Syrian territory, we learned this week. The threat of direct airstrikes surely to follow. But does an air war against ISIS in Syria end up helping Syria's brutal dictator, Bashar al-Assad? We put a number of questions to the U.S. State Department seeking more clarity about how the U.S. is confronting the ISIS global threat. On top of our list was this alarming assessment raised yesterday on our program by former State Department Special Assistant on Iraq, Ali Kadiri. Kadiri, you'll recall, said ISIS is well beyond warning shots. We can expect them to attack the homeland.
It's not an issue of if they come, it's simply an issue of when they will strike. We are at war, and we just, as Americans, have to unite and understand that this is going to be a long, costly campaign, but it's one that we have no choice in addressing. We can either pull back everyone and just wait for another 9/11, or we can take the fight directly to the enemy.
So we put this warning about ISIS, or ISIL, as the Obama administration calls them, and a number of other serious questions about U.S. foreign policy to the deputy spokesperson at the U.S. State Department, Marie Harf.
We, of course, monitor very closely whether or not ISIL will seek to develop plots aimed at the West, particularly the United States, which is really beyond the geographic area where they've been operating in Iraq and Syria. We're doing that right now. We've seen them say they want to attack the homeland. ISIL has come out and said that. We obviously take that threat very seriously. I think of particular concern right now is the many Westerners, including some Americans, who have gone to Iraq and Syria, have Western passports, and could travel back home and possibly carry out acts of terrorism. I also do think, though, that when we look at the threat terrorist organizations play, we need to be very precise with what information we know and what capabilities we've seen them display when we talk about this threat.
The head of ISIL, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, wants a war with the United States. Is it U.S. policy to give him one or to deny him one?
Well, 2 points on that. The first is that if people attack our citizens, if people threaten us, we will take the fight to them, and we won't be restricted by geographic boundaries when we do so. But I want to make very clear that this is not about ISIL versus the United States. This is about ISIL targeting and killing anyone in their path. They've killed a number of Syrians, Iraqis, Shia and Sunni Muslims, Christians, Yazidis, and now an American. So this is a fight that everybody in Iraq, in Syria, in the region, and indeed the rest of the world should come together to fight, because even though ISIL may want to make it about what the United States is doing, that's really not what we've seen on the ground here. We've seen them target indiscriminately anyone. We will play a key role, though, in pushing them back and really taking the fight to them.
So you're telling me it is a war, it's just the U.S. and everyone else in the world should be in it.
Well, we all need to fight this threat together. We need to do things like cut off financing to ISIL, which comes from not just kidnapping for ransom and criminal activities, but also from private citizens in other countries. We need to cut off the flow of foreign fighters to ISIL, working with countries around the region to not allow people to transit through their countries to Iraq and Syria. There's not just a military solution here that's clearly a part of it, but it's really a comprehensive solution. And most importantly, it's about building the capability of our partners on the ground, the Iraqi forces, the Kurdish forces, the moderate opposition in Syria. Those are all the kind of tools we're going to be bringing to this fight here.
One other point that Ali Kadiri made, he basically described Baghdad as already a rump state that is essentially a province of Shia-controlled Iran. Do you believe that? And is Erbil the new Baghdad in Iraq?
Well, that's some colorful language to be sure, but what we've seen is actually quite extraordinary on the political side. We have a process in place where there is a new Iraqi government being formed, where Iraqi leaders from all across Iraq, from different parties and different sects, have come together and worked to form an inclusive government. That process is ongoing. So we believe very strongly that one of the best ways to fight ISIL in Iraq is for a new inclusive government to get up and running, to show all Iraqis that they will defend them, that they are fighting on their behalf, and really bring the country back together in a way it hasn't been in the recent past.
Marie Harf, Deputy Spokesperson at the U.S. State Department, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
So the U.S. wants the world to join the battle against ISIS, according to the U.S. State Department. Well, they will all be standing in line behind the army that has been fighting ISIS from the very beginning. You'll recall that's Syria and Bashar al-Assad. The authorization of U.S. reconnaissance flights over Syria that we learned about yesterday may be bad news for ISIS, but it's good news for Bashar al-Assad, who would no doubt love some help in defeating what has become his main enemy in the Syrian civil war. Back in 2011, you'll recall, the U.S. called for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to step down. Today, it looks like the U.S. may need Assad in the fight against ISIS. Here to discuss all of this is Dr. Amer al-Azam, who is Associate Professor of Middle East History and Anthropology at Shawnee State University. He's a member of the Syrian opposition. Dr. al-Azam, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Thank you.
So how do we deal with this here? Are we allied with Assad right now? Is that the de facto situation?
No, not at all. And I think the White House and the U.S. administration have made it very clear right from the very start that this is not going to happen. And I think it's very important to recognize the following points. Remember, the Assad regime itself only very, very recently started to actually take the fight to ISIS. And I'm talking in the last few weeks and maybe months. And right before that, it actually was accused of being in alliance with ISIS. And it was very much using ISIS as an ally of its own to fight the moderate forces in Syria, to fight the opposition, and essentially left it well alone. So that's important point number one. Important point number two to remember is that the Assad regime itself is incapable of really putting up any real fight against ISIS. The Assad regime is very well armed. It receives plenty of help and support from Iran and Russia, and yet seems has demonstrated no real ability to stand against ISIS. And more importantly, it doesn't have the type of forces needed, the type of military fighting forces needed, and it's going to have to bring in Hezbollah. So in essence, the U.S. and our European allies would be allying themselves with forces like Hezbollah and Maliki's radical Shiite militias, who are actually doing the fighting for Assad right now.
All right. We're speaking with Amer al-Azam, who's Associate Professor of Middle East History and Anthropology at Shawnee State University. He's a member of the Syrian opposition. Well, you know, I'm a little confused here, because how do you thread the needle? How do you roll back ISIS and not assist Assad?
This is pretty much the problem that the U.S. administration is facing right now. And really, we shouldn't be here. I mean, I can only just recall going back to the spring and early summer when fierce battles were going around the city of Deir ez-Zor in the east of Syria, not far from the Iraqi borders, where the same tribes that we also want to recruit on the Iraqi borders are also found on the Syrian side, and those were abandoned to their fate. So what really we need to do is first and foremost develop the necessary support for the sort of allies that will be able to help us fight ISIS on the Syrian side. And the Syrian opposition and the moderate forces from the Syrian opposition have been calling for this support for over 2 years now. Now, we hope that this will, without sort of saying we told you so, but we hope that now this will bring about a change, because really the only effective force, in my opinion, that can really take the fight to ISIS, that can act as that counter from the Syrian side in the same way that the Peshmerga, the Kurdish forces, are doing in the north of Iraq, that we have been able to support with airstrikes, are going to be the Syrian opposition. And so you need to support those guys. You need to relieve pressure on them, because right now they are fighting a battle on two fronts, you know, the ISIS on one side and the Syrian regime on the other.
Well, Amer al-Azam, I mean, with all due respect to the I told you so idea, wasn't ISIS really a part of the opposition in the very beginning? Can you describe how they sort of, you know, wandered in and then turned into this force that really is confronting the entire world?
They were never part of the opposition. This is absolutely incorrect. I know the Assad regime would like to basically put out this idea. They were never part of the opposition, the actual, you know, when I think of the proper Syrian opposition. They're an al-Qaeda offshoot. It goes back to 2004, 5, and 6, when the Assad regime was engaged in actually fighting the United States and, you know, our presence in Iraq, when they recruited these extremely radical militant al-Qaeda types, trained them in Syria, and then sent them to Iraq to disrupt the Iraqi state building. And in fact, it got so bad that in 2009, Nouri al-Maliki, the same ally of Assad today, publicly accused Assad of killing Iraqis through sponsoring terrorist organizations like al-Qaeda in Iraq. It's those same groups, you know, that have drifted back and forth across the borders that were supported by Assad in the first place and helped the Assad regime help in their creation.
Amir al-Azam is Associate Professor of Middle East History and Anthropology at Shawnee State University. He's a member of the Syrian opposition, which he takes pains to point out does not include ISIS. Amir al-Azam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So did you catch the Emmys last night? A lot of wins for nice little edgiest shows like Modern Family. Ooh, so edgy. And Breaking Bad, which is edgy, but it's so ridiculously extreme, you can't take it seriously as social commentary. No big awards for the Netflix hit Orange is the New Black. Huh? A white woman's experience in prison that is not only plausible, it could be a reality show? Orange is the New Black goes right for topics like sexuality, class, race, transgender issues. People forced to meet some new people in their lives. Elections would be very different, right, if the electorate was like the folks in Litchfield Prison.
So you only run against white people?
I can only vote within your race or your group. Look, just pretend it's the 1950s. It makes it easier to understand.
See, everyone elects a representative from their own tribe. White, black, Hispanic, others. It's like student council.
But how is that an effective system? Not every Hispanic person wants the same thing.
Oh, sure they do. They don't want to come to America.
Jesus, your entire worldview is based on West Side Story, isn't it?
Can we get back to Lorna being racist? More of that, please.
I'm a sucker for this show. From the title to the social commentary, they're going for what other shows haven't really managed to do on television. Pushing the boundaries of race and class, friendship and female sexuality. They make the Emmy voters a little bit nervous, I guess, because they grew up on Maude, right? Maybe if we celebrated Orange is the New Black as something more mainstream, we'd be able to understand each other just a little better in America. Understand people having experiences we don't talk about. People we don't include in our protected little circles. Later this hour, we will be discussing the depressing statistic that 3/4 of white people in America don't have a single friend who isn't white. What do you think about it?
I'm Tana Elder, calling from rural central Illinois. Cultural differences, lack of understanding of what that means and how it affects us, fear of getting involved, this is why we don't make friends of other ethnicities and cultures.
Dennis Novak writes this on Facebook. Since I retired, I really have very limited interactions with black people, kind of a shame. Or Richmond, California. It's difficult to relate to other ethnicities. As a Mexican-American, I find it difficult to make white friends. What's your excuse for the separation of the races in America? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
A big idea now. Pope Francis has taken the Vatican away from some of the more petty concerns of scandals in the Catholic Church to try and put the Church out front on issues of human rights, economic justice, and inclusion. Francis has become an instant global leader on these issues, even beyond the expected importance of a pope's messages on world crises and current events. But the Pope recently entered into a conversation about war and confronting evil when he was asked about ISIS in Iraq and Syria and said that the aggressor must be stopped. The Pope raises the issue of a so-called just war without clearly addressing the situation in Iraq and Syria. Theologians have noted that this may be a problem for the Catholic Church, an institution that for centuries has been giving its permission for various wars. Bob Maher is a humanities professor at Hampshire College and the author of the upcoming book, Killing from the Inside Out, Moral Injury and Just War. He says the Pope has stepped into some very difficult moral territory, and the Vatican may not be the most credible voice to help us find our way through it.
There were three categories of just wars within the Church's just war tradition. wars declared by God, wars declared by the Pope, and wars declared by a legitimate sovereign or legitimate government ruler. Of all of those, the most just, the unquestionably just or righteous wars were those declared by God and those declared by the Pope. The Church has for 1,500 years endorsed, embraced, reinforced the just war tradition, which I feel to be extraordinarily unfortunate because I feel the just war tradition was mistaken from the very beginning and has caused a great deal of damage, that it is essentially a lethal lie. And the Church is responsible, is largely responsible for its origins and for its preservation. I am hoping, I continue to hope, that this Pope will step back from that, that he will re-examine, reconsider, and hopefully renounce for good that tradition and the Church's ties with it.
Pope Francis, of course, is not an ordinary person, and what he says has a force of spiritual law, perhaps. I mean, maybe that's going too far, but it certainly has a lot more gravitas than just an ordinary person speaking. But it's also the case that combatants and veterans and people that you've spoken to have a credible and nuanced view of this idea of just war and what justifies or doesn't justify violence. Explore that a little bit with me.
Well, first of all, there's a very important distinction that I've learned not from books, but I've learned from working with veterans, because they are the ones who have taught it to me. And that is the distinction between what is necessary and what is right or just or blameless. And this is something that is discovered in combat, and that is that killing, and that's what war is about, that killing, while it may on occasion be necessary, is never right. I've heard this over and over again from Marines, from soldiers, from airmen, that they discover this. It is a contradiction for most people to imagine that what is necessary can be evil, what is necessary can be wrong, what is necessary can be anything other than right. But this is what our veterans are telling us. And the reason why that's important is that our veterans are coming back altered. They're coming back haunted. They're coming back darkened by what they have done. But what they have done is following orders. They've served their country loyally and bravely at great risk and at great cost to themselves.
You know, Bob Maher, you seem to have identified, it seems to me, the real spiritual opportunity here for someone like the Pope. Because we often hear the stories of soldiers and veterans purely in terms of their sacrifice, thank you for your service, that sort of thing. But it's this deep ambivalence about what they've done that's wrong that we don't hear. That's not what comes out. And it seems to me the Pope has an opportunity to reach in and pull that out and offer some real spiritual guidance that would benefit all of us. Do you agree?
I certainly do. The first thing we have to do, though, is listen to our veterans. We welcome them back. We send them off and welcome them back and declare them heroes. But we say all too often, thank you for your service, but no thank you for your comments. We don't want to hear from them. We don't want to hear their stories. We don't want to hear what they have to say. Those opportunities are few. For instance, one Marine veteran, Timothy Kudo, who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, has written and has said to me in a number of conversations that what he never realized until he went to war, until he was involved in combat and in killing, was that what is necessary, what he still considers necessary, and what he would return as a Marine and do again, is nevertheless wrong, always wrong. He says it's always wrong to kill, but sometimes it is necessary, and that is the cost, that is the moral cost, that's the spiritual cost that veterans, that soldiers, that Marines have to pay. That's what we're asking them to do. But we have a moral contract, we have a social contract with them when they return to understand what we have expected of them, the price they have paid for it, and what they need now to heal, if healing is possible, from that.
Bob Maher is professor of humanities at Hampshire College, author of the upcoming book, Killing from the Inside Out, Moral Injury and Just War. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, John.
Mostly on this program, we try to tear away statistics and numbers and get to the real people behind them. But forget all that. We don't care about the people. All we care about is the numbers. Why bother with names when you've got PPR, IPR, FPG numbers, all of the headaches from the latest RRBC, QBBCs? Just stay off the IR and maybe all your flyers will pay off. Your sleepers become keepers. Numbers rule in fantasy football. Numbers that come straight out of your big screen TV.
A 65-inch LED TV with DirecTV NFL Sunday Ticket. Yes, it's college football right now, but next week it will be NFL, and it will be pure fantasy football nirvana.
Actor and filmmaker Mark Duplass knows a thing or two about all this, and he was kind enough to help us put together a beginner's guide to fantasy football. He's otherwise known as Pete from FXX's The League.
He's a fantasy football genius, okay? No wife, no job, just pure football knowledge.
That's a TV show, of course, but Duplass wouldn't confuse a scripted sitcom with reality. No, no. Fantasy football, he says, is reality.
It is very, very real. I think the fantasy as it began was that, oh, since I cannot run and hit people hard, I will fantasize about it and draft them in my own team. That was the first couple of years. Now, it's very, very real and more exciting to people than actually being on the gridiron. The virtual gridiron of fantasy football is its own sort of gladiator coliseum at this point.
A couple of questions. When is it too old to play Dungeons & Dragons?
Yeah.
When?
Great question. It's never too old to play Dungeons & Dragons.
How about fantasy football?
Never too young to play fantasy football is more importantly, because my nephews who are like, 10 and 13 and 15 are now basically talking smack and have their own teams, and they're in like five leagues. So,
who can and can't be in your league, in your family, friends, peers?
Good question. I have a specific approach. I'm a bit of a workaholic, and so I just play in one league, and it is actually the members of the show that I play with. It's all of our cast and our creators, and I focus all of my energies into that rather than spread myself out over 8 to 10 leagues.
Who are the five people you would want in your real life league?
To me, the key to having a good league is your like third and fourth picks. Those make or break you. Your flex positions, who's going to be that second wide receiver you play. Your tight end is a big thing. So I focus more on what people would call the sleepers. I got, this year for me, the Saints got Jimmy Graham. He's going to be the number one tight end. Everybody's going to go crazy for him. But that basically means all the defenses are going to be double, triple covering him. So look to the Saints wide receivers. Look to like Marcus Colston this year, who's going to be available.
Who's a buzz killer in a league? I mean, who don't you want? What personality is like, please get out of here?
Well, everybody always says, well, I don't know if I want that, like, person who talks so much smack.
I dominated you last year like the 85 Bears.
They're great. You need them. They're like the Judas. You need them around to inspire people and to rally around. You need a good devil, basically, to hate. So I would never take that person out.
But you can have too many St. Peter's, right?
Yeah, you could. Yes, this is very true.
And Paul's never shut up, right?
Yeah, I think the person you really don't want is the person who is in like 8 to 10 leagues, popping in every now and then for one comment every 2 weeks on the message board, and it almost feels like holier than thou or better than thou.
So like the blind chess player playing six matches at once.
Yeah, you don't want that. You don't want that guy. Yeah.
True or false, the most fun about fantasy football is cheating.
You've almost phrased it incorrectly. I think the essential part of fantasy football is cheating, true or false, and that is true. because there is – and this is – I'm really saying this because there's so much randomness involved in whether you win or not, how your players perform. The smartest people end up losing in the league. The people who know the most about fantasy football lose all the time. The real fun of this game is finding ways to connive and canoodle and in that way, it is much like Game of Thrones, just more boobs and more blood than Game of Thrones, of course.
Mark Duplass is the star of The League. The new season begins September 3rd on FXX. Look at your contacts now. They're right there on your smartphone. Click through them, one at a time. Are you seeing a pattern? You probably don't need to be a sociologist to grasp that your contacts list very likely represents a high degree of, let's just call it, racial uniformity. I mean, here's an experiment. Invite the people on your list to an imaginary party. What faces will you see?
It's a world of laughter, world of tears. It's a world of hopes and a world of fears. There's so much that we share that it's time we are aware. It's a small, small world.
Okay, fine, maybe you're an exception, that's nice. But you would be the rare exception. The findings in an actual survey conducted by the Public Religion Research Institute says it would be a very monochromatic party indeed. Blacks, in fact, are 10 times more likely to have white friends than whites are to have non-white friends. And 3/4 of white Americans, according to the survey, have not one but zero non-white friends. Is there any excuse for that?
This is Matt calling from Portland, Oregon. Sometimes I find that the environment that you're in sometimes isn't connotative to being around diverse individuals. Sometimes your hobbies or job just causes you to be surrounded by people of light color.
This is Roman calling from Redmond, Washington. I was lucky enough to go to a very diverse public junior high school, Richmond Heights Junior in Miami, Florida, and I was also lucky enough to keep many of these friends all my life. And I think this is one of the reasons why I have friends of many different backgrounds.
A lot of you from the Pacific Northwest really wanted to weigh in on this subject. It's a sample of your responses from that region to this idea. But let's go national. Let's dig into these numbers. We turn now to Arun Venugopal, host of the podcast Micropolis. Hey, Arun.
Hey, John.
So is this a real shocker, all this sort of bubble sociology that we apparently are condemned to live?
If you'd asked me even a few days ago, I might have been mildly shocked. But the thing is that, you know, a lot of us are looking at Ferguson these days. And, you know, I've been kind of digging into these, you know, what is the reality across America in these neighborhoods, in these suburbs? A lot of them are like Ferguson. I mean, and the data on this is going to kind of confirm what you've been talking about here, which is that, you know, whites and blacks live in very different worlds. And I know that sounds like, yeah, no kidding, Arun. But basically, let's just look at the data that this scholar, John Logan, he's a sociologist at Brown University. He dug through the 2010 census data. And let's just talk about the typical white person, okay? Typical white person lives in a neighborhood that is 75% white, okay? There's 8% black, 11% Hispanic, 5% Asian. That's a typical white neighborhood. The typical black person, on the other hand, lives in a neighborhood that is 45% black and 35% white, 15% Hispanic, 4% Asian. So there's a lot more white people that are in the typical black neighborhood than there are black people in the typical white neighborhood. So you're talking about the people they really rub up against in their daily lives, the schools that they go to, and probably, I'm guessing, the extent to which they're comfortable dealing with people of different races, you know? I mean, Logan has been doing this for 40 years, and he said when he set out in the 60s doing this, he was like, oh yeah, things are going to change real fast. And he's like, you know, now I realize that things are pretty bleak.
Every decade, I have reason to think that now things are changing, opportunities are opening up, black middle class is expanding. Whites are changing their attitudes. They're in all the survey research, it shows that they're less resistant to having a black neighbor. And by golly, we elected a black president. So by 2010, you might have thought that we'd see better outcomes than this. But actually, the color line turns out to be extremely persistent.
You know, and it's persistent on so many levels. I was looking at the New York Times front page, and here's that, you know, typical story of the cop in Ferguson and then Michael Brown on the other side. And it's, you know, two different worlds. And I, you know, read that and I said, oh, good journalism. But then I said, but why do we accept this? Why do we just accept that that's a reality? And I think kind of we do. And that's what these stats show.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think that people are talking about, like, Ferguson is going to be the thing that really, like, I think Sharpton, Al Sharpton was there yesterday, Reverend Sharpton at the funeral saying, we have to make sure we don't just sit around and just talk about this. But actually making that difference, I mean, who knows what's going to happen a month from now? A lot of these incidents, they happen in neighborhoods across America, and they reflect also different degrees to which we interpret these situations. You know, Ferguson, black people are like, yeah, this is a really big deal. This is, you know, reflects a huge problem. White people are much less likely to think that. They think more likely to think that, okay, enough, or enough of Ferguson. And so they're, you know, they have different worldviews.
What do you say to the listener who says, well, just enough already? It's a free country. We live wherever we want to live. Just get over it.
Actually, we don't necessarily live where we want to live. The fact is, these neighborhoods, they're not just like free market playing out the way it's supposed to. There were laws, there were zoning regulations, there continue to be all kinds of ways in which people have been sort of shunted into neighborhoods, maybe against their will, or if you're white, it's the way you like to. In the 50s and 60s, the Mad Men era, you see those beautiful suburbs. I think for a long time we thought, oh, that's just the way that it is. They're lovely, but actually they're noticeably lacking in diversity, and that's for very good reasons, because they were made that way.
Institutional choices, institutional issues that we're now seeing reaping the psychological and social consequences of.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we think of this as maybe a parlor game. Hey, how many friends do you have in another race? It's a little funny, a little embarrassing. But, you know, you look at other countries, people have done research on this. In cities, say in India, Hindu-Muslim violence is considered this terrible thing. And experts have looked at this. Ashutosh Varshney, who's also from Brown University, like John Logan before, he said, like, you know, the cities where it exploded were the cities where people were not interacting, where Hindus and Muslims were not hanging out with each other.
Does Logan suspect that there is a social cost in the sense that pressures are rising and that Ferguson, triggered by a shooting, is something that would be revisited and maybe wouldn't require a shooting to have the same sort of tension play out on the streets?
Well, I mean, he certainly thinks that Ferguson is not unusual. This is a typical suburb, you know, in terms of statistically. It's poorer than the other neighborhoods in Missouri, the typical neighborhoods. It's you know, got higher crime and that kind of a thing. It's a suburb that used to have a lot of white people. Those white people left. You know, it used to be very white, and in the last 30 years, it's now very black. So a lot of people think that this is not unusual. This can happen in other places.
Arun Venugopal is host of WNYC's Micropolis. What makes American friendships so segregated?
I'm Charlie. I'm calling from Bowling Green, Kentucky. De facto segregation, we naturally gravitate to those with similar cultures and backgrounds, and in most cases, those with the same skin color is the reason why I feel that three-fourths of white Americans don't have any non-white friends.
This is Ruth from Canton, Ohio, and I have several friends of several different races, but I also live in a very racially diverse area, and I choose to live here.
This is Barbara. I'm from Jersey City. I was raised in suburban New Jersey in an all-white suburb all through high school. But what I would say is now I live in Jersey City, which is a deeply diverse community, and I have constant contact with people of color from all over the world, which gives me a lot of comfort and confidence. But those years of being the only black woman was deeply diminishing, and I avoid it at all costs right now. I always try to be in settings where there's diversity in economics, in sexual orientation, in race, ethnicity. And while it's essential, it's survival for me, but I also would challenge white folks who live in Jersey City to make an effort.
Weigh in on this subject. We'd love to know what you think. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway or give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Join the conversation. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com. Personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.